Hey, everybody. If you are a writer or an aspiring writer, or if you just love literature, I have a book for you. It's called Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. It is the long-awaited craft book by Steve Almond, based on 3 decades of his writing career, a career that has featured at turns depression, failure, anxiety, self-loathing, despair, self-doubt, loss of faith, delusions of grandeur, and the occasional triumph. It's a book about the writing life. Steve Almond has done it. He has embraced it, the full catastrophe, and he has lived to tell about it. The Boston Globe says, quote, "This isn't just a book about writing. It's a book about honesty." And Richard Russo calls it, quote, "one of the best books on writing I've ever read. It's also the funniest by a country mile." Once again, it's called Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories by Steve Almond, available from Zando. Go get your copy right now, wherever you buy books.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hey, you guys, this episode of Other People is brought to you by the Litbreaker Ad Network. Litbreaker helps book publishers, authors, and premium brands reach an engaged audience of authors, artists, editors, agents, producers, bloggers, media professionals, and readers. Lots of readers. Litbreaker ads appear on The Rumpus, Large Hearted Boy, HTML Giant, Full Stop, The Nervous Breakdown, Plowshares, and other high-quality magazines and blogs, featuring literary, arts-oriented, and pop culture content and above-the-fold advertising. Visit litbreaker.com for more information about advertising packages. Litbreaker is also accepting new partner sites in literary, general interest, mystery, creative writing, young adult, romance, and other book genres. That's the Litbreaker Ad Network, an ad network for the literary, arts, and culture web. Be sure to visit litbreaker.com for more information. It's an ad network for smart, interesting, readerly people. Go and advertise on it. Oh my God.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jesus, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible, you know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person at just one time.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Everybody, here we go again. This is it. This is Other People. This is the opening monologue. This is a podcast situation. Thank you for being here. My guest today is Megan Abbott. She is a past winner of the Edgar Award, among other honors. She's a decorated novelist who is able to combine plot-driven narrative with real... literary sensibility. She's got skills, and I'm very pleased to have her here. Her latest novel, Dare Me, is due out in paperback later this month on August 27th, 2013. It has received all sorts of plaudits from the critics, and it looks like it might become a major motion picture. So keep your eye out for the paperback. That drops on August 27th, once again. But before we get started, I would like to read some mail. I got a lot of mail regarding episode 195, my conversation with Adele Waldman, the author of The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P. And as I recall, we talked a lot about relationships and that sort of thing, and it seems to have struck a chord with listeners, both positively and negatively. I got a lot of tweets and emails and Facebook messages from listeners about this particular show, so I figured I would share a few of them with you. This first one comes from a listener named Matt. He writes, "Hey Brad, just wanted to shoot you a quick note about the Adele Waldman episode. Not to lean too much on the side of being, quote, nice for the sake of being nice, but I really enjoyed the discussion of masculinity and relationships As a guy in his 20s, I've had that whole pregnancy complex and found what you were saying to be very much in line with my own reasoning, especially the part about not being capable of just easily having that kind of quote-unquote fun. Anyway, it was my favorite episode I've heard so far. Hope all is well out there. Best, Matt. And when he talks about the pregnancy thing, it's something I said during the show, during the conversation with Adele, about how when I was dating, you know, back in my younger years, how I was paranoid that I was going to get girls pregnant. It's like a paranoia that I think a lot of guys have when they're dating and they don't talk about. So clearly Matt's, you know, in agreement with me there. And then another listener named Juliet writes, "Hi, Brad. I really appreciate the conversation you had with Adele Waldman about gender dynamics. It was really nice to hear two people discussing their thoughts about male and female relationships while simultaneously considering their own inner bullshit detectors, as well as potential biases, judgments, and personal feelings they or failings they might hold. I especially liked what you had to say about people of either gender thinking of themselves as being on the same team, because that shit really pisses me off. But then I started thinking about, quote, other team or other, quote, teams that I consider myself to be a part of, ones that don't have anything to do with common interests, like writing. These teams are populations who have gone through similar struggles, so maybe I can understand that team way of thinking after all, to an extent. I'm not proposing any answers or suggestions here, just thanks for being so open and honest and thoughtful on your show, and thanks for giving me some cause to think. XO, Juliet." And then finally, Max Millwood, the program's most devoted and passionate critic, has some thoughts. He sends me a full critique of every episode. Lengthy critique, as many of you know. And his feelings on the Adele Waldman episode veered more toward the negative. "Dear Brad," he writes, "first, the monologue was a mistake. Reading a poem by another writer is tacky. It leaves a bad taste in listeners' mouths whenever you break the unspoken pact between you and your audience of not bringing actual literature into your program and not outright judging literature, either good or bad. Your program has a good track record with this issue, so it was unfortunate to see you succumb to an easy exit for the show's monologue." And he's referring to a poem that I read by Michael Earl Craig, who I really like. And then as for my conversation with Adele, Max says, "At first we thought Waldman would be chiefly responsible for this show's meandering messiness. Early on in the interview, she, along with every other college student who just discovered naturalism, was talking about how she wanted to make her characters real and complex. But soon we realized that it was you, Brad, who was driving the interview into the ground. After saying repeatedly on past episodes that you want to devote less time to talking about feminism, sexism, and misogyny, you then proceeded to devote the entire 195th episode to these topics. How should men be? Is that really what you asked for this show? I don't know what else to tell you at this point. For months, I've been saying that your obsession, your weird agenda, your conscience smearing when it comes to sexism is so abundant that I, for the first time, wanted to turn this episode off. Did you grope someone in high school or something? What are you repenting from? Why do you continue to dedicate large percentages of your show to one social sub-theme? It's gotten weird, Brad, like the paranoid obsessions in a schizo's head. With all the plentiful topics in the literary industry and literature itself, the fact that you pigeonhole yourself to one tired subject is bad podcasting. You're so much better than this awful habit. I think you think this was an adventurous, wild show, but it was the exact opposite. Whatever. I'll see you next time. Sincerely, Max." So, there you have it, folks. That's some feedback on episode 195. And I appreciate it. If anyone out there wants to email me, the address is letters@otherpeoplepod.com. And you can also tweet at me @otherpeoplepod.
To answer Max's question in particular about why I have such an interest in these particular areas lately, and I've talked about this before, but I think it's twofold. One, I think it comes from reading a lot about this stuff online, and then two, I think it comes from having a daughter, being a parent. So for number one, over the years, over the past, however many years, I've continually noticed in my social media feed and elsewhere a lot of women, many of them writers, issuing complaints and writing essays about feminism and women's issues and discrimination in publishing and elsewhere, and feeling like maybe I was out of touch, or maybe, it started to make me feel like I wasn't understanding something, because there was a lot of noise happening in this particular realm, and it didn't make complete sense to me. And then I started to worry that maybe I was complicit in it via my ignorance. And then secondly, I'm seeing things through the lens of parenthood and trying to make sure that I have some degree of understanding of what it is to be female, because I'm now charged with the responsibility of raising one. I've been over this. I've talked about this. And you know what? I understand the criticism. I do think I've talked about this enough, and I don't want to talk about it much anymore. But with Adele, I don't think that the episode was really about feminism or misogyny centrally. I don't feel like that was the core of the episode, and I don't feel like it was necessarily a repetition. To me, we were talking about relationships, which is different. And specifically, like male-female relationships and that whole dynamic, because that's what Adele's novel is about. That's the big theme. So it made sense to go there, and it felt germane to talk in those areas. And frankly, I wanted to pick her brain, because she had spent years writing this novel and had done a lot of deep diving in that realm. And then lastly, I do want to confess that yes, I did grope some girls in high school. Or at least I tried to. It never really went very well. But I gave it my all.
Hey everybody, if you are a writer or an aspiring writer, or if you just love literature, I have a book for you. It's called Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. It is the long-awaited craft book by Steve Almond, based on 3 decades of his writing career, a career that has featured at turns depression, failure, anxiety, self-loathing, despair, self-doubt, loss of faith, delusions of grandeur, and the occasional triumph. It's a book about the writing life. Steve Almond has done it. He has embraced it, the full catastrophe, and he has lived to tell about it. The Boston Globe says, quote, "This isn't just a book about writing. It's a book about honesty." And Richard Russo calls it, quote, "One of the best books on writing I've ever read. It's also the funniest by a country mile." Once again, it's called Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories by Steve Almond, available from Zando. Go get your copy right now, wherever you buy books.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
My guest once again is Megan Abbott. Her latest novel, Dare Me, is out in paperback from Regan Arthur and Back Bay Books on August 27th. Keep an eye out for it. It involves cheerleaders and crime and intrigue, among other things. And it's one of those books that pretty much everybody loved. So here we go, folks. This is my conversation with Megan Abbott, the author of the novel, Dare Me.
I'm in Forest Hills, Queens, New York, home perhaps most famous because it's where the Ramones grew up. So that's its probably biggest claim to fame.
Now, are there like landmarks and like signs? So, you know, I feel like in I don't know, I've been to certain cities where they do a really good job of like telling you where so-and-so lived. And like, this was once the apartment of a famous artist. Like, is Joey Ramone's like house like marked or anything like that?
No, it's terrible. They do a terrible job of it. Nobody ever believes me. But I actually every day walk by the school where they used to hang out apparently afterwards and throw spitballs at people and stuff. And it seems like there should be a sign, but I don't know. There's, you know, people like to keep it on the down low here, I suppose.
No, see, I think it's like a point of civic pride, you know, and I think it's good to like promote, you know, those kinds of things. It's like, what's the word? I don't know what it is. It's good for the culture. It makes people feel good, I think.
Yeah.
In some weird
no,
way.
Exactly. And it's quite a claim to fame. I mean, it's a pretty, as far as Queens goes, it's not the most interesting of Queens neighborhoods. You know, we have the tennis stadium where the U.S. Open used to be. But other than that, there's not a lot going for it. So to me, anytime someone comes, I say, the Ramones, here, right here.
And hey, one day it'll be like, hey, Megan Abbott used to be.
That's right.
This is where she
That's
wrote
right.
her masterpieces.
That's right. This is where she walked by every day to talk about the Ramones to everyone listened. So.
No, but you seem to have carved out a great career in publishing for yourself. Like, you're writing books that I think have that kind of like desired crossover appeal that's really hard to get at, where you have like, you know, you get really good critical reception and you have this literary street cred and your books get credit for being intelligent and well-plotted and sophisticated. But at the same time, they seem to have popular appeal and also have some cinematic qualities that translate to the silver screen. Like, do you know what I'm saying? Like, is that something you consciously went for, or is it just kind of an accident of your sensibility and good luck or whatever?
It is definitely, thank you. It is sort of definitely an accident, I suppose. You know, I mean, nothing's really an accident. I mean, obviously, I try to do a bunch of those things, but a lot of it, some of it is luck in publishing, of course, and getting lucky enough to find the right people. But the I guess the sort of mix of the sort of, you know, literary and, you know, and sort of commercial or popular stuff is probably because and the movie part is I grew up loving movies and love story and I love plot. So that, you know, sort of the relationship between the book and the reader has always been the most important part to me, that sort of whisper in the ear element. So that's what I always try to keep at the forefront when I'm writing is, you know, who I'm telling the story to.
Do you have like a single reader in mind, or are you one of those people who like you're writing to your husband or you're writing to your best friend or...
No, I'm not. And some people say, oh, I write for myself. I don't do that either. I guess the kind of hungry ear, you know. I always loved those books that felt very like confessions or secrets. So I guess it's sort of the person who really wants to know, you know, what happens next? What, you know, dark places are we going to go? And that's the person I imagine, but they're not embodied in any way. There's a few people I try not to think about when I write. But,
and who are they?
Like my parents, or, you know. But it's always a little uncomfortable, but they've gotten used to it, and I'm trying.
Well, no, but you do. I mean, I think every writer goes through that, and it depends. I mean, sometimes people are writing intensely personal things, or they're revealing secrets about their life that their parents might not necessarily know or understand completely. And then there are other people who are working, you know, maybe further away from themselves, or they have, you know, different... layers, you know, there's more layering between them and the work itself or what's happening in the plot. But at the same time, what's happening in the plot might be sexual or like hyper violent, you know, whatever the case may be. And you do have to shut that off. Like, it's something you have to, I think, be kind of fierce about, because if you go into it afraid of what mom and dad are going to think, then I think you're kind of just cooked from the beginning. You know, you can't do that.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's the death of writing, you know, in many ways. You know, you just, you know, because it's so self-revealing. No matter what you're writing, even if you think it's really separate from your life because it, you know, superficially is, it's always really about some weird aspect of yourself that you're trying to sort of put these veils over. And so if you think about it too much, then, you know, you would never show any of it and the books wouldn't feel real or alive. You know, that I always love when I read a lot of books by the same author. When I start to see some of their obsessions or compulsions recur, you know, some people hate that, you know, oh, and Philip Roth talking about older men and younger women again. But, you know, you feel like you know the author that way when you see the things that just keep recurring. And I kind of love that secret insight into the author head.
Okay, see, that makes me feel good. Like, I will take that, you know, take that one step further and say that when a writer really gets his hooks into me or she really gets her hooks into me, I not only like to read everything that they've written, but I like to read it in chronological order.
Oh, the completist.
Yeah. Yes. I want to get to me, what's almost more interesting than the books themselves is like the author's like subtext, like the actual life story. And I like to read it in order because then it's like it functions more as like biography for me, you know?
Yes. No, that's really true. Because then you sort of sometimes see it in its rawest form in the early book, but it's not as thought through or complex. And so you sort of, it's interesting to see the evolution of it. And then I love to read, it sounds like you do too, author biographies of authors, and then you start to fill in, you know, the in-betweens a little bit with what you might know. Do you read author biographies or do you avoid them?
No, I love them.
Oh.
I honestly think I like them maybe better than the books themselves. Like the books themselves, like the fiction is wonderful. It has to be in order for me to want to read all of it. But like there's something so deeply satisfying of getting the full picture of the art and then the artist who created it. And I mean, look at me, I'm doing this podcast. I like to talk about people, or I like to talk with people and find out what makes them tick and how they actually went through the creative process. Like that's equally interesting to me.
Absolutely. And sometimes I like the biographies better than the author. It's not necessarily a fault of the author. Like Jack Kerouac is a writer I like. I'm not insane about it. I was when I was 15, you know, and it's not a criticism of him, but I love to read biographies about him and about the Beats, you know. So that's sort of an example of sort of his experience being somehow, you know, even more significant to me than just the books themselves. And then some authors, like I read the Raymond Carver biography that came out a few years ago, and that you just love them in concert because you feel like you understand the story so much better knowing the life.
Right, exactly. Like I mean, both of those guys definitely resonated with me, and it's funny how, you know, an author comes to you at a certain time in your life, and that means so much. You know, timing means so much in terms of when you pick up Kerouac at 15, 16, 17, 18, it's a completely different experience than when you pick him up at, say, you know, 35 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I had Joyce Johnson on this program a while back, and she just wrote a pretty great biography of him. And you know, one of the functions of reading these literary biographies is that in addition to kind of rounding out the art itself and giving you a deeper understanding of it, is that, you know, from a writerly perspective, I find it helpful to take them down off of the mental pedestal that I often build for them. You know, like when you read about like the nitty gritty of their lives and you see that they suffered and struggled much as you are suffering and struggling in whatever, you know, particular context it happens to, you know, be current, like it, I find comfort in that, you know, especially creatively.
Absolutely. And the sort of the strategies they figure out or don't about how to keep writing and how to keep producing. One of the things I loved in the Carver biography is how his life for so long, because he was so poor, you know, was so tumultuous, and he had to keep the writing space as even and steady as possible. You know, no matter what was going on in his life, what chaos, he just would not let anybody near him during the writing time, same time every day, you know. And so those kind of details are just gold, you know. They're just fascinating, you know, that he had sort of figured out how to make it work for himself, you know, and getting sober too in his case. But,
Well, that's the thing too, is that like the level of chaos that some of these people were able to endure, particularly like, you know, chemically, and at the same time, produce is sort of shocking, and also kind of like it sort of shames me because like I'm not dealing with like a massive full blown alcoholism, you know, like, extremely dire poverty, and yet I find myself like struggling to produce and you know do as much as they've done, and so you know it's fascinating to see, and I think for some people it's like their only you know bedrock of sanity, like that time is holy for precisely that reason, you know.
Right, they need it more somehow. Yeah, yeah, and I don't know. I just read the Richard Yates one too, and that was very sad. And his, I mean, and he, you know, struggling with both mental illness and alcohol. But you just like the stamina, the endurance. I just feel like I live such a pedestrian bourgeois life when I compare myself alongside those guys. But it's not you know, I'm glad that my life. Like that, but there is still a kind of glamour in it. I mean, I think I'll always glamorize writers.
Yeah, well, no, me too. And like the other thing too is that like rock stars, I think anybody who abuses substance like really heavily and yet like makes like really great, brilliant art. One of the things that always makes me feel good is that it makes me feel healthy. Because, you know, I've definitely dabbled in my life and, you know, I did my time or whatever as like a college student, but nothing too crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking at like Keith Richards or I'm looking at these guys and I'm going, God, I'm going to do great. I mean, they made it to 70, like knock on wood, but you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know? There's no fear there.
Right, exactly. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about your childhood, which you alluded to. With respect to the movies and then with respect to some of these authors that influenced you at a young age. And you also alluded to your parents earlier. And I think I read that your folks were both academics and writers. Is that correct?
Yes, they're both writers. My dad is a political theorist, and my mom writes fiction. So it was a book-loving household from the start. It was just the thing we did. We all read all the time, my brother as well. So it was sort of, it was always, you know, it was a great gift that they gave me that they didn't know that they were giving me, because I assume that everybody spent all their time at the libraries, you know, and just consuming stories.
So, and you you said you had just one brother?
Yes, a brother who's a book fanatic, but he's actually a criminal prosecutor, which is of great help to me because I all my books involve crime, so he's my go-to guy for weird crime stories and procedural stuff.
Oh my God, it's like perfect. He's like your perfect consultant.
I know. It's as if he did it just for me, and yet he will assure me he did not.
So, and you grew up in Michigan.
Right, suburban Detroit, just outside of Detroit.
Okay. Detroit's went through some rough times. I mean, has it changed? I mean, do you go back there and say to yourself, like, my God, what happened? Or is it...
Well, I grew up in many... I mean, it seems bad to people now, obviously, you know, being bankrupt and so forth, which is really bad. But when I grew up, it was sort of in its most... now infrastructure, it's its most dire, but it was a much more... frightening place and hopeless place when I was a little kid because it was sort of, you know, after the riots and the economic collapse there and in the suburb, there was a very, very volatile relationship between the suburbs and the city, and my dad worked and still works in the city, so I always loved it, but it was definitely sort of part of that, you know, there was a definite us versus them feeling between the two. And now that's really changed. And now there is this sense, I mean, it's sort of in the face of, you know, utter bleakness of excitement when I go there, because there's a lot of new stuff happening. Because somehow the clearing of the city has sort of sparked all this sort of DIY stuff and, you know, and music and people, you know, growing, making farms on the prairie land where buildings used to be. So there is something kind of exciting about it. It's energizing when I go back.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you say, because, I mean, and I get it, because it's like you don't want to dance at a funeral. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
mm-hmm.
there's something really bleak about the... you know, what's happened there. But at the same time, when you're in that kind of environment where things have really kind of bottomed out,
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of opportunity for experimentation and, I don't know, new modes of living, and cost of living has gone down. And I've been reading bits and pieces about Detroit and about like the art scene there and about people like just mm-hmm. like commandeering buildings and like turning them into like, you know, like gallery spaces or whatever it is, you know. So hopefully it regenerates.
Yeah, I hope so. And it was always, you know, we lived very close to the city, but there's a sharp dividing line. And I wrote a story about this once because for this collection called Detroit Noir, and I just have this sense that as a suburbanite, that the sort of expectation was to write about Detroit as being this terrifying place. But to me, as a kid, this is romanticization for sure, but the suburbs were really boring and I couldn't wait to get out of them, and I was filled with contempt for them. Now I don't feel that way, but for most of my childhood. But so Detroit seemed very glamorous and exciting and strange and exotic, and I always wanted to go there as a teenager, you know, to explore, and I think that was probably a source of inspiration for me as a young kid, reading those author biographies and sort of imagining what was possibly out there in the big wide world.
Well, yeah, and it's like, you know, you do have a heavy lean into crime and noir and all that stuff. And so can you trace that? You know, if you're coming from like the sort of pristine Detroit suburbs, or I don't know how pristine they were, but I'm assuming they're similar to the Midwestern suburbs I grew up in, where there's like lawns and grills,
yeah.
and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, you know, I guess there's something underlying all of that that's sort of noirish that might not be apparent at first blush, but you know, what else was there in your life that drew you into like that mode of thinking creatively?
Yeah, it's always the sort of mystery, because I think there is a sort of sinister quality to the suburbs, but I'm sure I wouldn't have known it then because it was, you know, all I knew. But I think it probably came from the movies, old movies as a kid. This is the earliest I can trace it to, which is that I really developed a fixation with gangster movies early on. I always joke with my parents because I didn't know these weren't new movies. They used to take me to, there was a revival house, and we used to go and see Public Enemy and Scarface and Roaring Twenties, and I just loved Jimmy Cagney, and there was just something about the energy of them, and talk about tight storytelling. You know, it'd be like 70-minute long movies, and you know, it would be the rise and fall of an American icon. You know, and I just loved it. I loved all the bootleg alcohol and the flappers, and you know, all the energy of it, I think. And so that's, I think, started me on a fascination with crime or the criminal, and that sort of then segued into an obsession with true crime, which sort of, you know, everything went from there somehow. So I think, I mean, obviously it probably comes from something before that I have repressed, but that's the earliest I can remember.
Well, you know, it's funny because, like, I think about my suburban youth and I think about the noirish aspects of the suburbs, and I think, you know, there are some like legitimately heavy, dark things that happen in, you know, places that aren't the inner city, you know?
Right, right.
And, you know, and I can recall certain incidents, or like there were some heavy tragedies or whatever that were like, you know, around when I was a kid that sort of stick to you because they're so anomalous. But I think, too, in retrospect, that because you live in these places that have this polish to them, and, you know, there's a lot of outward happiness, and there's a lot of surface level perfection, and like the lawn looks nice, and there's cars in the driveway, and the dad's mowing the lawn. And then, you know, as you grow up and you start to come to understand, at least on some level, that human dysfunction, you know, lives everywhere. Because it's happening in that sort of surface level, amid that sort of surface level nicety, I think it makes it seem more noirish. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I could not agree more. I think that's beautifully put, because there is this sense that everything has to be hidden in the suburbs that isn't exactly as it should be, you know. So we're always ashamed of something in the suburbs, you know, because, you know, no one really fits those ideals at all. So there's this, you know, I think that, you know, it's a sense of shame and hiding and guilt. It's sort of a permanent state, I would say, you know. And so you know, that, then you, you know, when you sort of, when I visit them now, I sort of see that heavy in the air, and it lends this kind of exoticism and glamour to it. It becomes like blue velvet, and you think, what's really going on? I remember when I saw that movie when I was in college, and I thought, that's it. That explains everything, because, you know, it's just like peel back one layer, and you have all the sort of dark emotions, urges, and traumas of life just there, but they have to be hidden all the time. So everything feels hypercharged and hyper-emotional for that reason, because you're not supposed to show emotion.
Well, right, and now you live in New York City, and I live in Los Angeles, and, like, you walk out the door, and it's just like, oh, my God.
Yes. It's the stench of humanity all the time.
Yes. I'm like, just take me to the frickin' suburbs so I can, like, chill out in somebody's lawn, you know?
I know. I want to go to the mall,
right.
You know?
I just want an Orange Julius and some peace.
Oh, my God, I so miss Orange Julius. I almost put that in every book, and then people tell me it's too old now to talk about. So.
No, nobody except Brad Listy knows what an Orange Julius is.
Oh, my God.
So, okay, so bookish childhood, unusual fixation on, like, old-timey movies. So, like, gangster movies, I'm assuming film noir.
Yes, that came after. Yeah, definitely
okay.
After that. Was
so,
big.
Like, Barbara Stanwyck, Venetian blinds, and cigarette smoke was, like, your thing.
Absolutely. You know, it was that whole sort of moody, you know, we're all going down kind of feel, you know, it just, I just wanted to be a part of that. And of course it was sort of a genre where women were real badasses and really exciting to me. And that was pretty great too, to see, you know, cause this would be like the late 70s or early 80s when you have like Charlie's Angels and Love Boat, and these were the women I was seeing, you know, on TV. And not that, you know, Charlie's Angels can't kick ass in their own way, but there was something about seeing Barbara Stanwyck, you know, with a gun that just felt far more powerful, I think.
I get that. Yeah, she was great, you know, and like I remember like I took a film noir class in college, but like Gilda, is that film noir?
Gilda, yes, definitely. Like, yeah, that's totally a real perverse movie.
Yeah, that's a great film. And like I really, you know, The Double Indemnity. And then there was one called like, was it called, not U-Turn, that was an Oliver Stone film, but there was one called like Dead End or... God.
There is one called Dead End, but that's probably, are you thinking... not sure which one you're thinking of. They all have the title Dead End, though, but...
Right. But there's one, I don't know, I just remember really, like, that particular genre...
Are you thinking of Detour?
Detour, that is the one.
Yes! Oh, God, that is so dark and strange.
Yeah, it's a great film, and I really like film noir as a genre, as a movement in American film, because it's really distinct, and those movies hold up so well. Like, I think...
Yeah.
You know, in a way that, like, maybe not a lot of films do over time, you know. Just a lot of fun. It's funny that you came to that so young. You know, your parents...
Yeah.
Did your parents really push that on you, or is it like you got one taste and you were like, this is me?
They didn't push it on me. I think in some ways they were sort of befuddled by it and sort of delighted. they didn't seem to be bothered by it. And I think they were probably glad that, like with anyone with kids, just glad that they're interested in something, you know, and they're off the streets.
So, right.
You know, and it must be interesting to you being in Los Angeles, because I didn't go to Los Angeles for the first time until I was in my late 20s. And you watch those movies, and so many of them are set there, and they, you know, Sunset Boulevard and Double Identity, and that became the sort of dream place for me, would be, you know, that LA is the place where, you know, murder for hire behind the doors, you know, desire gone wrong, and, you know, you see all those street names and it doesn't even feel like a real place. I mean, how did you end up there?
Just graduate school and like an accident, essentially. Like, I still feel like I'm living here by accident. It's been like 13 years now. it's interesting because I think there's a connection between what we were talking about earlier with the juxtaposition of noir and the suburbs and the, the whole crime fiction, how much crime fiction is set in Los Angeles and what a what a tradition there is of,
right.
You know, those kinds of stories taking place here. I think part of that is just the fact that the movies were shot here. But I think that when you talk about surface level perfection and the strange, like, you know, non-weather and like there's not even any wind, and it's like you live on a soundstage and, you know, it's always beautiful and there's all this glitz and glamour. But underlying that, there's a whole hell of a lot of crazy. And there's a lot of menace, you know, and it's this big, beastly place, and it's a really easy city in which to disappear.
Absolutely. And it's a place where people always reinvent themselves, and identity is really slippery because it's a place you're allowed to do that more than any other place. Take a new name, take a different path.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like I definitely feel that because, like, there can be times where I'm like, my God, it's so beautiful here. You know, you can, and it happens in pockets, you know, and these pockets tend to be like buttressed right up against like pockets of like ugliness.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
Like Los Angeles, there's no sense to like the way it's laid out. So you'll be like 1 minute like staring up at the hills or out at the ocean or whatever and be like, my God, it's magnificent. And then the next minute, you know, there's just somebody like lying in the street or you're just like...
Right. You know. No, it's extreme everywhere. And one of the reasons is that you know, people have traced noir to sort of L.A. is it's at the end of the country. So it's the end of the frontier. It's sort of the last place, the terminus. And there's that famous Raymond Chandler, I think, phrase where he talks about it being the edge of nothing. And you really have this sense that this is it. This is as far as you can go, which I think adds to this sort of big sort of romantic and terrifying grandeur to it.
Yeah, like I always call it like the city, like at the, I feel like it's like the city at the bottom of the hill into like which everything sort of slides. It's like I just kind of like tumbled down into here or something and like wound up here. But I want to talk to you a little bit more about how you came to writing as a young person. Like I've sort of got like the groundwork done in terms of like the kinds of stories and films that were exciting to you as a young person, but like how early was it that you had an inkling that you were going to write stories?
I wrote a lot as a kid, but I never thought I would be a writer. I guess because part of, you know, reading all those writer biographies, Fitzgerald's, I just didn't think it was something one could really be, despite the fact that my parents were writers. But they weren't novelists, and it just, I kind of backed into it. I didn't want to sort of own it or admit that I wanted to be one until really late, until I was in graduate school. I intended to teach literature, and then I was working on my dissertation, which was on hard-boiled fiction, film noir, of course, and I just read a bunch of books all at once, written in the 30s and 40s, all noir, and I just started writing this novel on the side, and I didn't think it would really become anything, so I really fell back assward into the whole thing, I admit. Clearly I wanted to all along, I just didn't have the guts. And somehow at some point I just developed the guts.
Would you know why? I mean, was it some sort of gradual thing or did you have like a moment where you kind of like stuck your sword in the ground and said, I'm doing this, like I'm going to have the guts?
Well, you know, probably if I hadn't had, I had a little bit of early luck getting an agent to be businessy about it. And if I hadn't, I might never have done it again. You know, but you know, when you write your dissertation, all you're doing is staring at the computer screen all day, doing really sort of complex theoretical arguments. And so the fiction became this relief. And maybe in some way I recognized that relief was really exciting and awesome, and I should do something with it, you know, as I'd never felt it before, you know. So I think, and then luckily just got a little boost early on that said, you know what, maybe this could happen. Maybe you could do something with this. And then it became compulsive. Then I couldn't stop. I literally couldn't stop. I still can't stop.
Okay, so let's talk about this little boost. What do you mean, like, by the lucky break with the agent?
I didn't know how it worked. No one told me, and I sent a query. You know, they told you if you need to. I didn't even know you need an agent to sell. I didn't even know how you sold a book because in academics, you can send it straight to an editor, but you can't. You know, and so I was told you have to get an agent, and I sent a query letter to an agent, and he agreed to look at the manuscript, which, you know, now I just. Total blind luck. I bought, you know, the book, you know, Agents, Your Guide to Agents, Literary Agents, and I picked the first name, and it was just one of those happenstance lucky things. Nothing has been that lucky for me since in publishing, by the way, but that was.
So wait, like the first agent you queried signed you?
he eventually signed me. He didn't sign me right away. He, in fact, when he read the manuscript, he said, it's not ready yet. You need to keep working on it. But that was sort of like, oh, now we're in it together. You know, I had a compadre and I had a focus, you know, so I knew it wasn't, you know, that there was sort of a purpose to this. So that sort of gave me that sort of fire. I did end up having to rewrite a lot of times, even before he signed me, and certainly before it went out to editors. But it just gave me just that sort of whiff of, you know, the possibility of this.
That's all you need, and then like you're hanging onto his leg, like, okay,
yeah,
we're friends, right? We're friends.
Remember me.
Yeah. It's amazing just how little hope. Is plenty enough hope for an aspiring writer. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, like, so true.
The tiniest like little glimmer of sunlight, and we're like, yes.
It's so true. It's like even now, if I'm feeling particularly bad, and you know, like one little comment on Twitter, someone will say, "All right, I'm not going to hang it up."
Right. Yeah. So you know, and then conversely, like one like negative tweet or like shitty review, and it can be like, you know. It's hard. It's hard to manage all that. I think
it is.
You know, so
there's no hiding from it now either. You know, I mean, I don't read reviews. After my first book, I just sort of stopped because I was fixating on them so much. But now you can't avoid them. You can choose not to read them, but people will tweet about them or tell, you know. So there is, you know, with the way social media is, you will hear what people say, no matter what.
Like you're like that, you know. Like one of your friends comes up and just tells you something awful someone said about you.
Yeah,
you're like,
yeah.
Thank you so much for keeping me informed.
That's right. Yeah. Can always count on you.
Right. So we're missing like a window. Like you went to the University of Michigan, and you studied.
Yes, I studied English Lit there, and
did you go crazy? You don't seem like the kind of person who went crazy in college. Were you pretty studious?
I was really studious. I had my Sylvia Plath phase, okay. You know, as every self-respecting college girl. I wrote angsty poetry, you know, about, you know, bad boyfriends and, you know, et cetera. But,
have any of that on hand if you'd like to read some?
Oh my gosh, I tell you, I would be so afraid to look at them now because I would have to relive those bad boyfriend experiences. but it was sort of a license. I mean, I think she was the Barbara Stanwyck of writers. You know, she was so aggressive and angry, and I was so glad to have that, you know. Spent a lot of time, you know, the University of Michigan is a big school. Spent a lot of time wasted with frat boys, and you know, I had to sort of push through that and come out the stronger for it. So,
you ran the gauntlet of frat boys.
Well, something like that sounds really, really creepy. But yeah. It would be a good noir tale. But
I was picturing more like some sort of like football obstacle course, but you know.
Yes. No. Yes. That's right. That's right.
Okay, and so like cheerleading, because that mm-hmm. figures into your latest mm-hmm. book that's now what coming out in paperback, and mm-hmm. You know, like that whole high school scene. Like, were you a cheerleader? Were you involved?
No,
you were not. So this is all like an outsider's perspective. This isn't something you lived through.
No, I was really the opposite. I was the, you know, editor of the high school paper girl, and you know, it was not my thing at all. But in fact, when I was a teenager, cheerleading was very different. Or you know, it was very, it was really the most popular girls would wave pom poms and dance a little and from the sidelines, and that's what it was. But now it's really frightening and terrifying sport. And I learned that kind of by accident, watching it on YouTube of all places. When I saw what had become, I became sort of fixated on, in fact, because it was so not my high school experience in many ways, but also in, I guess it goes back to what you were saying about the suburbs and the sort of perception we have of the way people live there and what goes on beneath it, because the cheerleader, I guess she interests me because she's supposed to be so perfect and pert and the American ideal, so sunny, so happy. And then when I started to watch at these, what some of these stunts and these sort of hardcore things that these girls do, it started to speak to, I guess, this inner ferocity and this sort of, you know, so that contrast, I guess, is really what drew me to the subject.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Like that would just, that's exactly like what we were talking about, where like the outward smile and the pom pom, and then underneath it all is just like anger.
Yes, exactly. And girl rage is, you know, we're still really uncomfortable by it in general. I know I am, and I am a girl, or you know, in after a fashion. So it was a sort of great, you know, because you can get away with a lot if you look like a cheerleader.
Yeah. Well, I just remember in high school, you know, because I had a pretty traditional, you know, in some ways kind of old-fashioned high school experience when I look back on it. I went to high school in Indiana because we moved there after growing up the first half of my childhood in Wisconsin. And, you know, so basketball was very big. And I just remember being, like, in the old gym and, like, you know, watching these games. And you'd have these, like, really beautiful young cheerleaders, you know, dancing and doing all this stuff. It wasn't, like, super sexual, but I mean, I think back on it and I think about like all the parents were sitting there and like the girls are dancing for them. Like there's something sort of weird about it.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. And it's sort of, I guess, sort of post American Beauty or something. You can't sort of forget that element. And it's kind of a shame because there is a wholesomeness to it in part. You know, there is something really kind of beautiful, but especially in a place like Indiana, or, you know, where it's sort of, it was this thing everyone was doing together, you know, in its original form, and it was really something kind of lovely about it, but of course it never was that way, you know, it never will be now,
yeah,
because
I mean,
it is, you know, it's spectacle for consumption.
It's a spectacle, and it also, it's like a titillation, and it's something, there's something about the man, or the male-female dynamic, I don't know, there's just something odd about it. And I think about it now as a parent, and I've said this to my wife before, but like if my daughter wants to be a cheerleader, I think I'm going to be like, I mean, I'll let her do just about anything, but I would feel weird about that a little bit.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I have to be honest. I think I'd be like, why don't you go play something?
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's what interesting. Like the really good cheerleading squads now, they don't want to cheer for the sports at all. They don't do sideline cheer. They just cheer at competitions, and they find it really boring to cheer for boys. So I thought that was an interesting development. That they're really kind of, to them, it's a waste of time to be on the sidelines or to just do the halftime thing. They want to compete against other squads. So it really becomes maybe closer to you know, gymnastics or something, you know, a really competitive sport. That said, I don't think I'd want my daughter to do it because she could die.
One of my friends in junior high got thrown up and landed on her head and almost was paralyzed.
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah.
She could never do it again, and like it, you know, it was really scary. And I was like, what, 13 years old at the time, so I was like, oh, is she okay? Like, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, hindsight, it was like, holy cow, like that would have been a disaster.
Absolutely. And I think we're more used to it now with dealing with football. Of course, football, they have helmets and they don't go that high in the air either. You know, it's a weird dichotomy that we let girls do this pretty much uncontrolled. And in fact, we encourage them to do it. But it speaks, I think it's interesting about those girls because I do think they're kind of like gladiators in that way. And
yeah.
And I interviewed a few of them, and one of them, which was my favorite, she said she was in college now and she had damaged her spine terribly in high school doing it. And she showed me pictures of it and everything and had to have surgery. And she said she'd still be cheering if she could, and she hoped to be able to do it next year in college. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, but, you know, it's interesting because it's like I talk about like the titillating aspects of it and like the weird sexual part of it, you know, with regard to like sideline cheering. And I think that like the movement away from that into like a more of a, like, you know, gladiator type competition, while it comes loaded with all these dangers for the girls, is actually maybe like the right impulse, you know, like,
right.
You know what I'm saying? It's more of like a it's what Barbara Stanwyck would do.
Exactly.
While she was
would be a cheerleader.
But while she was cheering, she would be smoking. That's the only.
Oh my God! I just, that's the greatest mental picture. And I bet she could wield a pom pom like nobody.
I'm thinking like yeah, like a pom pom in one hand and like a cigarette in the other would be the greatest thing in history.
Yeah. And an anklet, you know, like in Double Indemnity.
So, okay, so there's that. And then the other thing that I want to ask you about relative to Dharmi and you know, the world of it is female friendships. Mm-hmm. And, like, especially adolescent female friendships and, you know, just how intense they can be and how, you know, the fights are just different. I know guys, you know, teenage boys can sometimes fight with one another and guys can have their own conflicts. But, like, I grew up with sisters and I sort of have like some window into that. And, you know, you've written an entire book that I think, you know, touches upon that and kind of dives into those kinds of psyches and lives. Like, what did you learn about it? Like, have you arrived at any conclusions and what can you tell us?
from my anthropological journey, that part I absolutely remember and identify with, because there is something about, I mean, I think it's so, in many ways, so much healthier and easier for boys, because if they have fights, they can, you know, go out by the bike racks or get it out of their system, or, you know, but, you know, girls aren't supposed to do, I mean, sometimes they do that, but, friendships are like, they're really like grand romances at that age, with all the intensity and the infatuation and the, you know, I've got to be around you all the time. And then, and then inevitably the betrayal. And I think they're sort of testers for how love is going to go in life, no matter who they, you know, choose to take it with. And I think it's just sort of the testing ground for a lot of the pain of life to come, but without having the sort of skills or tools to know how to deal with it. And unfortunately, in this sort of peer situation that everyone is in high school, where the humiliation is 100 times greater. You know, and now if you have a love affair and it goes badly, you know, as long as you keep your social media to yourself, you know, it's a secret. But in high school, of course, everything is exposed. And now, for high school students now, even more so. I mean, can you imagine being in high school now?
I literally thank the stars every day that I did not have like a camera phone and social media when I was like going through adolescence, because like, think about having all that stuff like on the web somewhere. That would be, talk about mortified.
It's just, sometimes when I see even the old snapshots that just I have, I'm horrified. And when I think of what that could mean and how quickly, you know, your reputation can be ruined, and how, you know, and how the shaming can go far beyond your school and go global.
Well, no, it's funny to think about, like, for, you know, right when you said that, when you were talking about finding like an old snapshot that, that only you have, like what flashed through my mind is like either you or me, like finding like a photo, like in an album, like an actual physical photo of which there is only one copy, and being so humiliated by it that like, I'm thinking to myself of like putting it in a lockbox and then like taking a boat out into the middle of the ocean.
I know. Why are we keeping these at all? Right after this, I'm going to go and burn all those. I mean, they could be found at some point or digitized in some fashion. And, you know, I mean, it is, it's just not an age that should be documented, much less, you know, disseminate it.
But we're gonna need that for your literary biography.
Right. What would the biographers do?
Like, I just want like a big photo section in the middle of it, of just like you with like, you know, bangs and headgear.
Oh God, the bangs. The bangs alone is reason enough to do serious burning. But it you know, you don't have relations. I mean, you don't have friends. I mean, I think this is true with boys too, but I think it's especially true with girls. You don't have friendships like that ever again, thank God, in many ways, because your world is so small. And, you know, and then it ends. And then that sort of, you figured stuff out when you're done, you know, when you're through it. But those friendships can be just so damaging and so destructive.
Well, and I think, like, it's interesting to hear you say that it's, like, kind of a testing ground for how love might go and how, like, there's an intimate, like, it's almost like it's like you're play-acting intimacy with another girl, regardless of whether or not you're into girls, you know,
right,
like sexually. Like, and I think that you know, I think women have, generally speaking, like a more sophisticated emotional understanding, or just like a more sophisticated emotional world in a lot of ways, you know, like, mm-hmm. like relationship wise anyways. Like I think back on my high school buddies and like, you know, there was some of that. And you know what? Like a movie that I absolutely love is Superbad.
Yeah, which
I think is like just like, I don't know. It's one of my all-time favorite movies. I love that movie. And I think it's funny because it sort of plays on that gender reversal where you have guys like sort of being like, you know, like they're like in love, you know, and like they're going to separate. And it's like this horrible thing. And that resonated, you know, and I kind of think that there's some of that with guys. But with girls, it seems a lot more intense. And I think it's just a different kind of friendship.
Yeah, no, it's just, I think it is the same, yeah, but it can enact itself in different ways, and I think with, you know, I think there's still some boys at that age, maybe still, unless they're playing sports, you know, are a little uncomfortable being physical with each other when we girls are not, and so that kind of, it becomes a physical intimacy too, no matter what you're doing. You know, girls are always all over each other at that age, and I think that sort of also makes it more, it's totally acceptable, and in fact encouraged sometimes for them to be so. So there's that adds to this sort of hyper intensity of it. And in girls that age, you know, they don't have a lot of outlets to, as we were saying, to be angry too. So when they get angry at each other, it can take all kinds of, you know, terrifying and screwed up forms for that reason too. You know, a lot of this sort of, how can I humiliate someone? And so that makes everything feel bigger too. And now, you know, in high school, you know, at the end of the day, if I had a bad day in a fight with a friend, I could go home and not have to think about it necessarily till the next day. But now your school is with you always because it's on your phone, it's on your computer, you know. Okay.
So. I hate it. It was better
when for your daughter.
Well, yeah, it was better when you could disconnect. It was better.
Yeah.
I don't care what anyone says. Like, I don't, like, I have such, I mean, there are certain conveniences that my phone affords me that I appreciate, but if they were taken away from me tomorrow, I would survive. And I would say, like, 75% of it bugs the shit out of me. And I just, you know, it's like constantly people texting me.
You
know, like,
yeah.
I don't know. You know, I might go old school at some point and like have like a full revolt, but it feels hard to do. You know,
I know. I fantasize about that a lot because I do think some ways my phone is like this living thing, this sort of enemy. It's like an alien being. It's this enemy of mine.
Right. But you know, maybe we bitch too much. Like it's like, you know, you can like talk to it now and it'll tell you where to go. And I don't know. There's certain aspects of it that are magical. So I don't want to be.
I like Instagram.
There you go. Okay, so like just to kind of finish out the adolescent girl thing, and you know what you learn, because you know in writing this book, you talked about watching YouTube videos, you talked about actually interviewing cheerleaders, so you did some actual physical on the ground research, and then you dove back into this world, and you know I don't know how good your memory is or how you know alive that time of your life remains to you, but like for me, so much is lost. Like my memory is just increasingly bad, and I don't know. I can't remember anything, or maybe I choose to block it out. So when you go back into this stuff and suddenly you're talking to cheerleaders and you're, you know, I don't know if you went back to your old high school or you did anything weird like that, but what came up for you? Like, what did you learn about yourself? Like, did you find yourself remembering things and being like, oh my God, I did this? And
yes, no, definitely. And I would have said the same thing you said. I would have thought, I don't remember any of that. I blocked it all out. But once you start to open that door, so don't open the door, you find it all comes flooding back. And I sort of have this memory of like the note, because this is, you know, girls would write notes to each other, you know, and they would be pages long, like endless, you know, and, you know, we would talk for like 2 hours on the phone at the end of the day. I started to remember all this stuff about, you know, what were we talking about? What were in these notes? You know, what could we have possibly said to someone who I would see like 16 times in a day, but there was
like now, yeah, nowadays, like I can barely like come up with like a text message to my best friend.
I know. I can't imagine if I kept any of his notes looking at them, that would be too mortifying. But I definitely remember passing these long multi-page, you know, line rule notebook pages, notes, you know, to my friends, you know, throughout the day for updates, you know, updates on the important issue with Victor in civics class or what do you see, you know, I don't know what it would even be, but that kind of compulsiveness and that sort of hunger, and that sort of needing to be engaged and needing to sort of, you know, always be checking everything and always be, you know, and the other part that I had forgotten about was how I have no idea what was going on with my parents during those years at all. It's like they didn't exist. I did talk to them about that. Like, oh, you went, my mom went back to college when I was in high school. I have no memory of it at all. From going to classes, I don't remember that, you know, because I, you know, and then that sort of became part of the book, that parents don't even exist, because at that age, for a lot of teenagers, you know, really all, they only exist to occasionally, if you can't get a ride home, you know, really it.
That's just heartbreaking, because my daughter's like 3 right now.
Oh, but my relationship is very good with her now because of that. I was not, you know, we were not in each other's face, you know, it wasn't that kind of thing, you know, they respected my space.
You know, I guess you got to. It's like, yeah. It's a weird ritual. You know, like in adolescence, you're sort of preparing to leave the nest. So you need to like practice it, just like you were kind of talking about with respect to, you know, rehearsing love relationships or whatever it is. You know, there's all that stuff, and it sort of makes sense to me.
Yeah.
So with regard to the actual writing itself, and you mentioned earlier that you became, like, once you sort of got a taste of it and you got a little luck with regard to the agent, you couldn't quit and it became this compulsion with you. So how do you work now? Like, are you an everyday writer? Are you like nonstop, like super prolific? It seems like you're pretty prolific.
Yeah, I write. I write every day now. I have to, but that doesn't mean I'm actually writing all, you know, as I'm sure you know, I have to be in the head of a book all the time, you know, for at least most of the day, or I lose the book. I lose the feeling of the book. So it's this awful itch when I'm away from it. So I can't say I enjoy writing at all. I find it really miserable, but I absolutely love finishing for the day or having written or so. It's sort of, I mean, it is a little, it's something a little drug-like about it. You know, you're just sort of craving that feeling that will come. If, you know, if I put this time in, then I'll get that feeling of relief after, and then I won't have to do it again until tomorrow or something. So that, I guess that's the compulsive aspect of it.
Okay, that makes me feel good, because I'm like that. And like every time I talk to a writer, and it does happen where they're just like, I just love to write, and I love it. I'm always sitting there going, Jesus, I'm such a dysfunctional mess. Like, what is
I know. I don't know if they're lying. I don't know if there's something I'm missing. I don't know what could be enjoyable about it.
Well, I've thought a lot about this, and it's not even with respect to writing alone, but like, you know, I consider myself a relatively, I don't know, I can hear like people, like friends of mine laughing now, but I consider myself relatively well-adjusted. Mm-hmm. I'm decently happy enough, but like I don't like to overstate those kinds of things, and you know, life is hard, and I don't like to deny that, and I'm trying really hard to be honest with myself, and I think sometimes part of that can lead me to maybe indulge negative feelings because I'm like, this is real, or you know what I'm saying. It's hard for me to navigate, and yet I have friends who I think might be blessed like neurochemically with like just a sunnier predisposition. And sometimes I find myself dealing with people, whether it's writers or whether it's just friends, who if you happen to be melancholy or you happen to be talking about something that's not necessarily super sunny, they respond to your admission or your confession with like extreme happiness. And what I think about it is that I feel like some people are like almost competitively happy. And my feeling, and I think this is actually kind of like tying together nicely now, there's a through line with what we've talked about, is that I think that there's a lot of anger underlying that surface level happiness. And when someone is like competitively happy, and it's like, you know, because I've had situations where I'm like, you know, something legitimately shitty has happened to me, and I've like told a friend, because, you know, that's what you're supposed to do, right? Like, you're not supposed to bury all this stuff. It's not healthy, and they're your friends, and that's who you're supposed to turn to. And I tell my friend, like, you know, X happened to me and it was really authentically shitty. And then, like, they respond by texting me, like, pictures of their kids. And I'm like... Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, yeah. wait a minute. And I think like in their defense, they might not know quite how to handle it, or maybe they're like pissed off that like.
I think that's very aggressive.
Right. It's like, fuck you for being unhappy. And like, I don't know.
And reminding me of my secret unhappiness. That's right. What I think it is.
Yes. It's like, it's weird psychologically to untangle all that. But, you know, at the same time, like I kind of admire people, writers and just people generally, who are like they work really hard at like being happy and like taking a positive attitude. Like I could take a lesson from that. Like I need to have a better attitude a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way?
I do because I don't want to, you know, it's sort of like, wow, you're getting to do the thing you want. You spend a lot of time doing it. You spend a lot of time getting to talk to people about books because you do it and you love books more than anything. What is there to complain about, you know?
Right.
And so it's sort of like you have to sort of, you know, secretly or you'll find your little, you know, little group of, you know, fellow, you know, bleakers and then sort of talk about it together.
But see, it's more bleak to me to be like fake nice or fake happy. I fucking hate that. Like,
yeah,
I don't want to be like Debbie Downer. But I just want to be real in the moment, or I don't know.
Yeah. I think that's energizing though. I think it's different than Debbie Downer. Debbie Downer is, oh, everything's so hard. I don't want to do anything. But I think there's something really energetic about talking about, Jesus, this is hard. What do I, God, this page sucks. Like, what, you know, I feel like there's something really kind of, you know, like, and then you talk about it together and you sort of mobilize in this kind of witchy fashion. Energy, you know, this kind of dark energy can kind of crackle from that. And that, you know, I think, you know, from dark places, you know, I guess maybe that's where I think the most creativity comes from.
Well, let's hope, right?
Yes, please.
So, Dare Me, the film rights have what been optioned? Is that how you phrase it? And so, is this happening? Is this a go, or has it just been optioned?
Well, it's a go for now. You know how you know out there. I wrote the script for it, and we have a director now. So, you know, fingers crossed.
Well, wait. Okay, so wait. You wrote this. You adapted your own book.
Yeah.
That's a little bit unusual.
It was very awful. No, it was a very difficult experience. Experience, but really interesting. It was, you know, you have to, you know, breaking apart your book and putting together something different felt really, I'd never reread any of my own books before. So
right.
The whole process was new and strange. But
it's something that you've been going back to your childhood. Like this is something you've sort of been preparing for your whole life. It seems like.
I had to seize the chance when I had it because of that. You know, I always think when I write, I think, like a movie. I don't think this is going to be a movie, but I think about it like movies because that's how I guess I first learned story structure. So, I had to try it for sure.
So, can you tell me who the director is?
The director is Michael Soucy, who did Grey Gardens. Did you see the HBO movie?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, do you have any? Is anyone attached to star?
They're talking, though, I mean, this could change by the time I get off the phone, with Natalie Portman for The Coach, and they're talking to different actresses about the young girls, but it's all sort of, you know,
it's not real. It's not real until it's real. You know?
Exactly. And I have been told, not even until the cameras actually start rolling. So they don't even like to give me updates because I'm such a movie geek. I want to hear everything. So I try to steer, you know, it's probably for my own sanity.
Well, I will keep my fingers crossed for you. And this has been really fun. I've enjoyed talking with you, and I congratulate you on the paperback release and on all of your success. And hopefully, you know, I wish for you that you get the experience of getting to, like, walk down the red carpet at the movie premiere of your own book, because that would seem like a full circle experience.
Indeed. Barbara Stanwyck.
Right. Just pick up smoking for that night only. I want you.
That's
just,
right.
I want you out there just, you know, rocking it. So,
excellent.
Congratulations to you. Fun talking, and best of luck on whatever comes next.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Okay, you guys, there you go. That's Megan Abbott. Great talking with her. I really enjoyed that. Go get her novel. It's called Dare Me. It's out in paperback from Reagan Arthur and Back Bay Books on August 27th, 2013. You can find Megan online at meganabbott.com. She's on the Twitter.
where her handle is at Megan E. Abbott, and I believe you can find her on the Facebook too. Thanks to Kill Rock Stars, as usual, for all the great music. Be sure to check out killrockstars.com. And hey, don't forget to go get the app, the free official Other People app. It is available now for your iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch, or Android device. It's the best and most elegant way to listen to this podcast. How many times do I have to tell you this? New episodes automatically upload to the app. You can download episodes to listen to offline. You can favorite your favorite episodes. And you can also access premium content and the full archives all via the app. So please go get that if you have not done so already. The app itself is free. Okay. Otherwise, I'm going to stop talking about feminism as much as possible. Sometimes it comes up. It's not necessarily my fault. Sometimes my guests, they might talk about it, and you know what? That's okay. No subject is off limits here. But at the same time, I don't want to keep beating the same drum. I don't want to seem neurotic or fixated in a weird way. Nor do I want to sound nauseatingly precious and self-conscious on this particular line. I'm just trying to figure my shit out, you know? Please remember that Anthony Trollope worked for the British Post Office for 33 years and that Buster Keaton died in Woodland Hills, California. That is it for now. Thanks for being here, you guys. Thanks to Megan Abbott. Go get her book. The paperback drops on August 27th. I'm just going to keep repeating that until you go pre-order it. Otherwise, I will be back in just a few days with another show, another writerly person, another episode, another conversation about non-gender related issues. I'm trying. Do you realize that? I'm trying to offer you variety and quality and